Chapter 8. Swimming in the Same River Twice. After a year heading the main control directorate, Putin grew tired of conducting investigations that yielded mixed results. He had uncovered corruption only to have cases stall in a judicial system that he understood was easily manipulated. He had little power to challenge the vested interests of officials, and yet he also showed little zeal for crusading to change the system. "It was not very creative work," he recalled. He claimed later that he considered leaving Yeltsin's erratic government for the private sector in the winter of 1997 through 1998. He thought about creating a law practice, though he doubted he could make a living with it. What stopped him, indirectly, was the looming collapse of the new Russian economy, and very nearly the state with it. By the beginning of 1998, Putin was swept up in what was described as the revolution of unknown middle managers. Yeltsin turned to these faceless young apparatchiks in order to avert a national calamity and his own political demise. The year after Yeltsin's re-election and convalescence following heart surgery, the country appeared to have stabilized after its lurch through its post-Soviet crises. Inflation eased, and the economy grew for the first time since 1989, although less than 0.5%. No one was exactly optimistic, but the worst seemed to have passed. "Everyone was filled with hope, myself included," Yeltsin wrote in his memoirs. "I hoped that by the second half of 1997 and in early 1998, we would sense that something in the country was changing." Something was, but not what he or anyone else imagined. The economic crisis that swept Asia in the fall of 1997 dragged down the world economy and, most critically for Russia, the price of oil. A barrel of oil at the end of 1997 sold for less than it cost Russia's oil companies to extract it. In the first 3 months of 1998, the industry that provided most of Russia's resources lost more than $1.5 billion. Government revenues, already depressed by rampant tax evasion and capital flight into offshore accounts, plummeted, and Yeltsin's government soon drained its reserves trying to keep up. On March 21, 1998, Yeltsin summoned his prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, to his dacha, where he now spent more time than he did in the Kremlin. Chernomyrdin had served in the office for more than 5 years, proving to be a bulwark in the government through the worst years of political and economic turmoil. With Yeltsin increasingly weakened and a new election already on the horizon, some thought he could be the president's successor, an idea that tormented Yeltsin, who wanted someone absolutely free of the influence of any political or financial groups. So he fired Chernomyrdin and then offered vague and conflicting reasons for his action. He claimed the country needed a technocrat, but in truth, he wanted a subordinate as prime minister, not a rival in waiting. Yeltsin's choice to replace him was Sergei Kiryenko, a former banker from Nizhny Novgorod. He was 35, nearly a quarter century younger than Chernomyrdin, and had arrived in Moscow only the year before to serve as energy minister. He only learned his fate the morning of the announcement, and according to Yeltsin, had to collect himself and make sense of it all. The Duma twice rejected Kiryenko's nomination, underscoring Yeltsin's waning influence and intensifying an atmosphere of political crisis. Chernomyrdin promptly announced he would seek the presidency in 2000, confirming Yeltsin's fear of his ambitions. Even some of the oligarchs who had backed Yeltsin 2 years before now threw their support behind Chernomyrdin, most importantly Boris Berezovsky. A short, balding former mathematician, Berezovsky had built a financial empire that included automakers, banks, oil, and a controlling interest in a state television network, ORT, which he wielded as an instrument of political power and vengeance. Yeltsin had appointed him to his Security Council after his re-election in 1996 and then promptly fired him. Berezovsky was mercurial and faithless. An ally was in his mind a temporary phenomenon, a security official once said. For Berezovsky, people are divided into two categories, a condom in its packaging and a condom that has been used. Berezovsky viewed Kirienko as a reformer in the mold of Anatoly Chubais or Boris Nemtsov, the young liberals brought in to restructure Russia's economy. In other words, Kirienko stood in the way of his business interests. He unleashed the full force of his television network against the nominee, allying himself with the communists in the parliament who despised him as a rich tycoon. Yeltsin succeeded in pushing through Kirienko's appointment only by threatening to disband parliament, as allowed by the constitution, if it failed to approve the nomination after 3 votes. Kirienko was narrowly confirmed on the 3rd vote. Yeltsin's opponents in parliament consoled themselves by drawing up articles of impeachment. The shakeup in Yeltsin's government created yet another opening for Putin. In May 1998, he took his 3rd new job in the Kremlin in less than 2 years. He was never close to Yeltsin and was not then powerful enough to figure in his intrigues. And yet, his competence and loyalty had enabled him to rise in the bureaucracy, often to the surprise of people like Chubais. This time, Yeltsin appointed him the first deputy director of the presidential administration, putting him in charge of relations with the country's 89 regions. The job was a natural extension of his work at the main control directorate, where he had amassed files of corruption and malfeasance by regional officials. Russia is nominally a federation of its regions, and though the Constitution of 1993 gave the president broad, centralized authority, many operated as independent fiefs. By virtue of their local elections, the regional leaders also had independent political authority and thus posed potential threats to Yeltsin's preeminence. Yeltsin's distrust only intensified when Alexander Lebed, his challenger turned ally turned enemy, won election as governor in the Krasnoyarsk region of Siberia in May, and made clear that his presidential ambitions had not diminished in the least. Putin saw the fractured political system as a symptom of the country's ongoing dissolution. Chechnya's struggle for independence was only the most extreme example of Russia rotting from within. The vertical, the chain of government authority, had been destroyed, he recalled, and it had to be restored. He told journalists that his main task now was to ensure that Yeltsin's decrees would be enacted at the regional level, but he emphasized that he did not intend a tightening of the screws. He never had time to do it. He would remain in that job for only 61 days, long enough to install a KGB colleague from Petersburg, Lieutenant General Nikolai Petroshev, in his old job at the main control directorate, but not to accomplish much else. 2 days after Putin's latest appointment, Russia's stock market crashed. Shares had lost half their value from the beginning of the year, wiping out millions of dollars of wealth, though only among the elite who could afford to invest. The poor had nothing. Arrears in wages steadily mounted, and strikes soon spread. Foreign investors began to withdraw their capital, while wealthy Russians socked theirs offshore. The privatization of Rosneft, the last state-owned oil company, was canceled because no one would even bid for it. A $4 billion credit from the International Monetary Fund stabilized Russia's meltdown, but only briefly. Yeltsin's government struggled to hold up the value of the ruble, but it was a losing battle. The government resembled a major fire department that had to hastily deal with the outbreak of more and more new blazes. One of the blazes that preoccupied Yeltsin involved the loyalty of the FSB. Even as the country's economy imploded, Yeltsin fretted over the agency's power. Yeltsin, who had done more than anyone else to break the iron grip of the Soviet Communist Party, could never bring himself to purge the intelligence agencies with the zeal that the Germans had after 1989. He relied too heavily on the intelligence officers and their commanders, hoping to restrain their influence in politics and society by pitting them against each other. For KGB veterans, the changes that occurred in the 1990s were disorienting and humiliating. many left the ranks to serve as heads of security companies that were soon mired in violent battles for assets. Others crossed into criminality, exploiting the government's weaknesses. Often, it was difficult to tell which was which. Shortly after his re-election in 1996, Yeltsin had appointed a KGB veteran, General Nikolai Kovalyov, as the director of the newly created FSB. He was the sixth head of the domestic security services since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Yeltsin considered him a competent administrator, but in office he developed an enormous personal antipathy to business and all its representatives. He simply despised people with large amounts of money, Yeltsin wrote. He was not alone among the security officers who retained their paltry government salaries, and, like many working Russians, watched as inconceivable fortunes landed in the hands of a privileged and, in their minds, undeserving few. Given the intelligence service's historic anti-Semitism, it is not surprising that much of their fury flowed toward the oligarchs who were Jewish. The Jews sold out Russia, they believed, manipulating the president and creating the economic crisis then unfolding. What alarmed Yeltsin most was that under Kovalyov, the FSB began searching for these new enemies of the people, collecting compromising material, kompromat, against the executives of banks and other companies, as its investigators had done against Sobchak. Now the FSB's zeal threatened people within Yeltsin's family, even Yeltsin himself. He decided he needed to rein in the agency. He needed his own man in the FSB. Boris Berezovsky, whose control of Aeroflot had attracted the prosecutor general's menacing attention, lurched in and out of Yeltsin's circle. He nurtured his access to the president's advisors, though he met more and more rarely with the president himself. Valentin Yumashev, a close Yeltsin aide, told him that Yeltsin no longer trusted the FSB's generals and their tightly knit clan. In early July, Yeltsin had announced plans to reorganize the FSB, including a sharp reduction in the number of officers at Lubyanka. But Kovalyov seemed less than eager to carry out the order. Yeltsin wanted to clean house, Yumashev explained, and asked if he had any thoughts about Vladimir Putin. Berezovsky recalled a deal he had made in Petersburg years before. He wanted to open a car dealership, and was surprised that Putin had refused even to consider a bribe, which presumably he was prepared to offer. He was the first bureaucrat who did not take bribes, Berezovsky said. Seriously, it made a huge impression on me. Whether or not Berezovsky's recollection was a factor, Putin had earned a reputation as competent and disciplined to the point of abstemiousness, though others noted his capacity for discretion. Yeltsin first noticed him when he served in the main control directorate. His reports, he found, were a model of clarity. In contrast to the endless chattering and scheming of his aides, Putin did not try to press any agenda on his boss, or even bother him with much small talk. In fact, he tried to remove any sort of personal contact with Yeltsin. "And precisely because of that," Yeltsin said, "I wanted to talk to him more." He was wary of Putin's coolness at first, but came to understand that it was ingrained in his nature. After meeting at Yeltsin's presidential retreat in Karelia to make the final decision to fire Kovalyov, the youthful new prime minister, Sergei Kiryenko, flew back to Moscow and summoned Putin to meet him at the airport when he landed. Neither he nor Yeltsin had consulted Putin about the job. He was then a mere pawn in the game of political chess that the president imagined as he lurched toward the end of his presidency. As he drove to the airport, Putin expected bad news, and, in a way, for him it was. "Hi, Volodya," Kiryenko greeted him, familiarly. As young as Putin was, the prime minister was a decade his junior. "Congratulations." "What for?" he asked. "The decree is signed," Kiryenko said. "You have been appointed director of the FSB." Putin claimed he was surprised, though the possibility of his appointment had been rumored in the media nearly a year before. He had even discussed the possibility with Lyudmila 3 months before, during an evening walk at the dacha in Arkhangelskaya, one of the increasingly rare moments when he spared time for her. He told her he did not want to return to the closed life of the intelligence world, which he thought he had left behind in 1991. "I had no desire to step in the same river twice," he said. Lyudmila did not relish the prospect either. As the wife of a rising political appointee in Moscow, she lived a far more open and interesting life, traveling frequently to Germany and elsewhere, though often only with the girls, not together as a family. Basking in her new freedom, she remembered the oppressive strictures of the KGB spouse. "Don't go there. Don't say that. Talk to that person. Don't talk to this person." Dutiful as ever, though, Putin did not refuse the appointment. He telephoned Lyudmila with the news while she was vacationing with their daughters on the Baltic coast. "You be careful there," he told her, "because I've been returned to the place where I began." Lyudmila was confused. She thought he had returned to Borodin's office, that he had been demoted somehow in the turmoil then roiling the country. "I've returned to the place where I began," he repeated. He had to say it a third time before she understood. She had to wait until she returned to Moscow to find out what exactly had happened to return him to the KGB's successor. "They appointed me, and that's it," he told her, and she asked no more questions. Kirienko introduced Putin to the FSB cadres at Lubyanka on the following Monday, July 27, 1998, and tried to placate Kovalyov, who learned of his dismissal from the news reports on television. He had served admirably, Kirienko said, but conditions are changing. People are changing. At the announcement, Putin expressed his appreciation of the president's confidence and vowed not only to carry out the restructuring Yeltsin had ordered, but also to focus on the government's strategy for easing the economic crisis, prosecuting economic crimes and tax evasion. He said he had come home. Kovalyov, although furious about his dismissal, handled the transition professionally. He showed his replacement around and opened the safe in his office. "Here's my secret notebook," he told him, "and here's my ammunition." 2 days later, Putin granted an interview to the newspaper Kommersant, in which he outlined his priorities and expanded the agency's traditional domestic work to include the fight against political extremism and nationalism, against foreign spies, and against the newly arrived and slowly expanding World Wide Web. "Of course, the FSB is not going to take the Internet under its control," he said, already expressing a wariness of the growing importance of the new medium. "But it understands that modern tools of telecommunications can be used to the detriment of the country's security." Putin's appointment caused grumbling among the FSB's veterans, also KGB veterans, who viewed him as an upstart and an outsider. He was from Petersburg and had served his entire intelligence career in provincial posts. He had never risen above the rank of lieutenant colonel. It was an extraordinary, unanticipated break for Putin, and an enormous advance in an unexpected rise. He had leapfrogged over far more experienced and qualified generals, who considered him a parvenu sent to impose the Kremlin's control over the agency, which is exactly what he set out to do. On August 1st, after returning abruptly from his vacation in Karelia to deal with the looming economic crisis, Yeltsin summoned his new FSB director to his dacha in Gorky, outside Moscow, to discuss the post. Yeltsin wanted Putin to make the service less politicized and to restore its prestige and authority, something that would send chills down the spines of the dissidents for whom Lubyanka remained a source of fear. Yeltsin proposed that Putin return to active intelligence service, with a promotion to the rank of general. Putin refused, however, recalling his resignation during the August 1991 coup. He also revealed to Yeltsin that in the 7 years since, he had remained in the reserves as the KGB became the FSB. "I am a civilian," Putin told Yeltsin. "It's important that such a power ministry be headed by a civilian." And so, he became the first civilian to head the FSB, and the last. Putin moved into an ascetically decorated office on the third floor of Lubyanka. He did not move into the old executive office nearby that had been occupied by Soviet intelligence chiefs from Lavrenty Beria to Yuri Andropov. He turned that into a museum that some considered a shrine. On his desk, he placed a bronze statue of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky, who founded the Soviet secret police in 1917. As the loyal servant he had always been, Putin carried out Yeltsin's instructions to reorganize the agency and reduce the central staff, a task that became even more urgent as the country's economy and budget woes worsened. He ultimately reduced the number of officers at Lubyanka by a third, to 4,000 from 6,000, at the cost of considerable discontent among those in the ranks who considered Putin's reductions a purge motivated by Yeltsin's politics. He also abolished departments he considered outdated and created new ones to address the most urgent security threats. They oversaw intelligence in the regions with a particular focus on seething Muslim areas, like Chechnya, computer security and telecommunications, and, ominously, the defense of the Constitution, a task that echoed that of the Fifth Chief Directorate, the KGB's agency that hunted dissidents in Soviet times. As he had since he arrived in Moscow 2 years before, Putin turned to lieutenants he could trust, the men he had known since his KGB days in Petersburg. Alexander Grigoriev, Viktor Cherkesov, and Sergei Ivanov, all generals on active duty, took up positions in the FSB's leadership. Yeltsin admired Putin's steely determination. "He did not allow himself to be manipulated in political games," he wrote. In the insidious rumor mill of the government at that time, it was wise for even a seasoned person to avoid entanglements. Putin immersed himself once again in the life of the intelligence agent, where everything is secret and everyone is suspect. "If you were an intelligence officer, you were always the object of a potential vetting," he recalled. "They were always checking up on you. It might not happen very often, but it was not very pleasant." Even as director, he felt the constant state of tension. He also shared the agency's paranoia. "They couldn't even go out to a restaurant," he said of his cohorts. "They thought only prostitutes and black marketeers went to restaurants. What would a decent officer of the security agencies be doing in such company?" The result was extraordinary discretion. When he once invited a pretty young reporter from the Kremlin press pool out for lunch at Izumi, one of the capital's new sushi restaurants, she arrived to find the new director of the FSB waiting for her alone, having cleared the place of other diners. The reporter, Yelena Tregubova, found him to be flirtatious, calling her Lenochka, and encouraging her to join him in drinking sake. That she did not honor his discretion, but rather included the scene in a book, hardened his opinion of the media and reporters, who were, in his view, little more than vultures who sought to exploit or embarrass officials for personal gain. On the evening of August 20th, less than a month after Putin's appointment to the FSB, a journalist in Petersburg, Anatoly Levin Utkin, left the office of a recently created newspaper called Legal Petersburg Today. He carried 1,000 rubles, then about $140, and a briefcase full of papers and photographs for articles in the next issue of the newspaper, which was only its third. Levin Utkin was a deputy editor at the newspaper, which had already gained attention with articles delving into the city's banks and the competing spheres of influence. One of the investors noted was Boris Berezovsky, who had publicly clashed the year before with other oligarchs over the privatization of Sviazinvest, the country's largest telecommunications company. Another article concerned Anatoly Sobchak's escape from Russia and the activities of his deputy for foreign investments, now the director of the FSB. Its headline read, "Vladimir Putin became head of the FSB unlawfully." Levin Utkin had written neither, but had contributed reporting for the articles. The newspaper's editor-in-chief, Alexei Domnin, said that both articles had prompted vociferous complaints from their subjects. Putin's people met with him to complain, he said, though he did not say who. The meeting had an obviously political nature that he did not detail. Complaints about press coverage were nothing unusual and often warranted, and the furor over the articles would have quickly been forgotten, except for what happened next. Levin Utkin entered the foyer of his apartment building on Rednova Street and was checking his mailbox when two men approached from behind and beat him so badly they shattered his skull in several places. The assailants took the briefcase and everything in his pockets, including his newspaper identity card. A neighbor found him unconscious in the foyer, and he was taken to the hospital. Surgeons operated twice, but he died on the morning of August 24th, having never regained consciousness. Contract hits in Petersburg had become so common, happening at the rate of one a day for a while, that Levin Utkin's murder would not have ranked highly if the journalists' organizations had not taken up his cause, appealing to the United Nations to press the Russian authorities for an investigation. There was never any evidence linking either Putin or Berezovsky to the fatal beating. Prosecutors doubted that the murder had a motive beyond simple robbery, though it was never clear that they seriously investigated the crime. It was the first time, though, that Putin's name and Berezovsky's surfaced in media reports in connection with the same death, and it would not be the last. The case, as it happened, was overshadowed by far more shattering events that August. 3 days before Levin Utkin's murder, Russia defaulted on most of its debts and devalued the ruble, wiping out the savings of millions of investors and ordinary citizens. Russia was on the brink of total economic collapse. The crisis deepened the political turmoil surrounding Yeltsin, seemingly signaling the end of his political career. On August 21st, the Duma called for his resignation. 2 days later, he fired Kiryenko instead. He had lasted a mere 5 months. Yeltsin then appointed as prime minister the man he had dismissed from the post 5 months earlier, Viktor Chernomyrdin. Yeltsin, the great democratic hope for Russia, had clearly lost his way. The bold moves he claimed to favor now seemed desperate. 4 days later, he appeared on television to declare that he would not seek re-election in 2000, and then all but disappeared for 2 weeks, making only 6 brief visits to the Kremlin at the height of the country's financial and political panic. The Duma, as it had with Kiryenko's appointment, twice voted against Chernomyrdin's return, but this time Yeltsin no longer had the power to bluff, since the parliament had prepared impeachment proceedings, and under the Constitution, the president could not dissolve parliament if an article of impeachment had been passed. A new confrontation loomed, as did rumors of a coup, fueled by reports that military units near Moscow had been ordered on high alert. The communists in the Duma braced for a repetition of the siege of 1993. In fact, they seemed to dare Yeltsin to order it. Then, on September 1st, Putin went on national television to deny that the Kremlin intended to use force to resolve a political conflict. He gravely declared in his televised remarks that the FSB would secure the interests of the people. "Those who violate the Constitution and try to undermine Russia's state system by unconstitutional methods and with the use of force will run up against appropriate resistance," he said. "This is something you can be sure of." Later, when a communist member of parliament, Albert Makashov, denounced Jews as a scourge that should be removed from the country, Putin announced that an investigation had begun into his remarks, even as the prosecutor general's office and the Duma itself equivocated. The controversy caused a furor in Moscow, with people taking to the streets during the communist celebrations of the revolution to defend Makachev and his anti-Semitic rants. Putin made his announcement with Lubyanka in the background, sending a message not only to the protesters, but also to the Secret Service, still infested with bigotry, that hateful expressions would not be tolerated. After just a few weeks on the job, he no longer seemed the inconspicuous aide he had always been, blending into the background. He exuded the full authority of the country's Secret Service and a fierce determination not to let political or popular unrest undermine the state's authority. As a grateful Yeltsin wrote, "I think his cold expression and the almost military precision of his formulations discouraged many people from causing trouble." Putin's public support did little to help Yeltsin, who had to abandon his nomination of Chernomyrdin. His aides, working with deputies in the Duma, settled on a candidate least objectionable to all. Yevgeny Primakov, who had been Yeltsin's foreign minister since 1996. Primakov was an old, genial Soviet academic, an Arabist by training, who had spent 14 years as a journalist in the Middle East, working closely with the KGB. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, he took over the Foreign Intelligence Service that had emerged from the ruins of the KGB, and where, from 1992 to 1996, he all but disappeared from public view, trying to revive the agency in much the same way that Putin had its domestic counterpart. Each was suspicious of the other. Primakov had far more experience in the world of intelligence, having been deployed undercover on missions not only to the Middle East, but also to the United States. Eager to bring the FSB under his influence, he was among those who suspected Putin of packing the ranks with colleagues from Petersburg. Putin took the whole FSB leadership to meet with him to prove he had not conducted a purge. On September 11th, the parliament voted overwhelmingly to install Primakov as prime minister, and the immediate political crisis eased. The desperate decisions of Yeltsin's government to default on bonds and devalue the ruble had sent shockwaves through society, but ultimately proved to be a revitalizing tonic, allowing the economy to resume growing, aided by a recovery in domestic production and the beginnings of an oil boom. Yeltsin's fortunes and health continued to decline, though. He was repeatedly hospitalized in the fall and winter, and the impeachment proceedings against him had not ended with Primakov's appointment. Meanwhile, a far more menacing threat to Yeltsin was emerging, and Putin's loyalty would prove decisive in defending against it. Putin had not been long in Lubyanka when he found himself at the center of a public scandal greater than any he had faced before. On November 17, 1998, six men held a strange and sensational press conference in Moscow. Four wore masks and dark glasses. The other two, unmasked, were Alexander Litvinenko and Mikhail Trepashkin. All were veterans of the FSB, and before national and international journalists, they sketched an alarming tale of corruption and conspiracy. The organized crime unit they worked for, they said, had itself turned into a criminal enterprise, running rackets with Russian mobsters and Chechen independence fighters, extorting businesses they were supposed to protect, and offering their services for hire, often with lethal effect. Their superiors, they said, planned to kidnap the brother of a prominent businessman, Umar Zhebrailov. They had ordered the beating of Trepashkin after he was relieved of his duties for investigating wrongdoing. Most sensationally of all, they explained how they had been ordered by the officers at the agency, now headed by Vladimir Putin, to assassinate Boris Berezovsky. Berezovsky, whose influence inside the Kremlin was never as great as he pretended it was, had privately told officials about the alleged plot against him. He even believed it to have been a factor in the dismissal of Kovalyov. Among Putin's first acts as FSB head had been to disband the organized crime unit that these men were now accusing of having gone rogue. He had dismissed or transferred most of the unit's officers, but an internal investigation into the assassination order against Berezovsky failed to result in any criminal charges against the unit's commanders. One prosecutor told Berezovsky that the order to kill him had been a joke. The closing of the case prompted Berezovsky to go public. He appealed to Putin directly in an open letter published in Kommersant on November 13th. "Vladimir Vladimirovich," he wrote, "you have inherited a difficult legacy from your predecessors. Criminal elements and officials at various levels, whom they have corrupted, including officials in your agency, are striking out at people who are unwilling to go back to being cattle. Criminal terror is on the rise in Russia." Berezovsky never explained the reason for his direct appeal. Some officials and newspapers suspected he was now trying to discredit Putin or others in the Kremlin, or, contrarily, to regain some of the influence that he had once had inside it. When the letter failed to accomplish much, the agents involved went public 4 days later. Alexander Litvinenko, the ringleader of the press conference, had worked for the KGB's Military Counterintelligence Directorate in the late 1980s, and then for the FSB in the 1990s, focusing on terrorism and organized crime. He was never a spy or an undercover operative, but rather an investigator and enforcer. Like Putin, he was fit, patriotic, and loyal to the security services, rising to the rank of lieutenant colonel. But by then, Litvinenko had grown disillusioned. He came to see the FSB as a rogue agency, especially the unit created in 1996 to fight organized crime, which was notorious for its ruthless brutality and corruption. The line between service to the state, to the oligarchs, and to the mafia became less and less clear, and Litvinenko himself crossed it. In 1994, he had been assigned to investigate an assassination attempt against Berezovsky, who had just left his auto dealership in a chauffeured Mercedes when a remote-controlled bomb exploded, raking the car with shrapnel. The driver was decapitated, but Berezovsky somehow survived. As Litvinenko collected evidence, he became enthralled with the ambitious tycoon and soon went on Berezovsky's payroll as his personal security guard and advisor, even as he continued to serve the FSB. Many officers, their meager wages often in arrears, moonlighted for the men with money. It was a symptom of the decay of the intelligence apparatus. When, according to his account, he received an order to kill Berezovsky in the winter of 1997, he refused and went to Berezovsky with details of the plot. Litvinenko began the press conference by reading a statement, then emphasized that the corruption they were disclosing occurred before Putin's arrival at the FSB at the end of July, and he appealed to Putin to cleanse the agency. "We do not seek to compromise the Federal Security Service," Litvinenko said, "but to purify and strengthen it." They had no proof other than their testimony, though they claimed otherwise. "I have made several attempts to get through to Vladimir Vladimirovich and present all these facts to him, but we did not have such an opportunity. We were simply denied access to him," he went on. And then he appealed directly to Putin. "I will take this opportunity. I think he will look at this taped press conference, and I would tell him the following. I have proof that his deputies are deceiving him. I can provide documentary proof. If he calls me to his office, I will show him these materials." The subsequent Führer put Putin in an awkward position. He could not simply rebuff Berezovsky, who still claimed to have influence within the Kremlin. At the same time, the charges were scandalous, and they infuriated him. Putin responded to Berezovsky's letter with one of his own, sent to Kommersant the day of the press conference. "We are not afraid to wash our dirty linen in public," he went on, saying that internal investigations would be conducted into any accusations. Obliquely, though, he warned Berezovsky, who is well known for his devotion to democratic values, that he was running a risk by interfering in FSB affairs. and he warned that if the allegations proved false, the FSB would have no recourse but to sue for slander, not only against Berezovsky, but also against the newspaper's editorial staff for printing his letter. Putin proved to be exceedingly intolerant of criticism of his agency and dissent within it. At the end of the month, Putin quietly summoned Litvinenko to his office, just as Litvinenko had asked for him to do. Litvinenko arrived with an armful of documents, including a chart that in his mind linked all the names and crimes he and his colleagues had known of. Litvinenko, presumptuously, imagined Putin as another lieutenant colonel like him, a mid-level operativnik suddenly put in charge of some 100 seasoned generals with all their vested interests, connections, and secrets. He was not sure how to address the man who now directed his agency. Comrade Colonel? But Putin preempted him by rising from his desk to shake his hand. He seemed even shorter than on TV, Litvinenko remembered thinking. The meeting was brief and, Litvinenko thought, chilly. Putin insisted on meeting him alone, without the two colleagues who had accompanied him. He politely declined to accept the dossier that Litvinenko had brought with him. Litvinenko described the meeting to his wife, Marina, as a disaster. I could see it in his eyes that he hated me. Putin had compiled his own dossier against Litvinenko and the others. On the evening of November 19th, he appeared on the state television network Rossiya and, though promising an investigation, insisted there was no evidence that any of the accusations against the FSB were true. He ridiculed the press conference as a spectacle with characters from a children's story, wearing masks, even though they announced their names. The ex-wife of one of them, he did not say whom, but apparently he did not mean Litvinenko, had called him afterward, he said, improbably, to complain that he had fallen behind on alimony payments. Perhaps this was the reason why he wore dark glasses. Then he turned the tables and said that the agents themselves had conducted illegal operations. Yeltsin summoned Putin to his dacha again the next day and demanded that he resolve the embarrassing and escalating scandal. Everyone knows what happens to people carpeted like this by a stern Yeltsin, one newspaper wrote about the meeting. Putin did not relent, though. Even if some of the agents' accusations were true, they were as complicit as their superiors. He considered that by holding a press conference, the agents had betrayed their oath of office as intelligence officers. Instead of investigating their claims, he presented the president with the evidence he had compiled of their wrongdoing. And then he fired Litvinenko and his cohorts. People like this cannot work in the FSB, he said. Putin's handling of the affair did not earn him universal support in the Kremlin. Rumors floated that Yeltsin would sack him for incompetence only 4 months into the job. The staff cuts at Lubyanka were not politically popular in the Duma, which continued to assault Yeltsin's presidency at every opportunity. Putin's position suddenly seemed precarious, all the more so after a prominent liberal deputy from Petersburg, Galina Starovoitova, was killed only 3 days after Litvinenko's press conference. Starovoitova was an ethnographer who rose to prominence during perestroika as a champion of the rights of Russia's many ethnic groups. She and Putin were never close, but their paths crossed in Petersburg throughout the 1990s, and she knew Sobchak and his wife well. In September 1998, she appeared on a television program with an apt name for the era, Scandals of the Week, and suggested that the renewed leaks of criminal charges against Sobchak appeared to be an attempt to discredit the FSB's new director, that is, Putin. She noted that officially Sobchak remained only a witness in an investigation, not a suspect. Only a deeply cynical conspiracy could somehow scorch Putin himself, she thought. I don't rule it out, at least, although, of course, it is ridiculous. On the night of November 20th, Starovoitova returned to her apartment on Griboyedov Canal with an aide, Ruslan Linkov. the assailants fired at least 5 bullets. 3 struck Starovoitova in the head, killing her instantly. 2 hit Linkov, who survived. The gunmen dropped their pistols at the scene and drove off in a waiting car. The attack, with all the characteristics of yet another contract hit, provoked international condemnation. To kill a woman in politics, that has not happened in Russia since Stalin's time, a supporter of hers, Sergei Kozyrev, said. Yeltsin denounced the murder, calling it a peremptory challenge to our entire society. He was so distraught by the news, an aide said, that he was hospitalized the next day. He and Primakov ordered Putin, the interior minister Sergei Stepashin, and the prosecutor general Yuri Skuratov to take personal charge of the investigation and demanded results. Starovoitova had recently declared her candidacy for governor of the Leningrad region, which, unlike the city, had not changed its Soviet name. She had denounced the nationalistic bile flowing in the parliamentary debates and amassed evidence of corruption in the Petersburg government. There was no shortage of potential motives and suspects. In fact, the police arrested more than 300 people in the weeks after her death. And yet the motive for her murder would never be fully established. Yeltsin, ill and frustrated, lashed out. He blamed the country's mounting problems that winter on the outbreak of communist hysteria, which included not only repeated denunciations of Jews, but also a call to return the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky to its pedestal outside the old KGB headquarters where Putin now worked. Yeltsin was infuriated by the inaction of our usually threatening prosecutor general's office in the face of what he saw as criminal incitements to overthrow Russia's democracy. Starovoitova's murder seemed like another crippling strike against the country, against him. As the chief of the country's domestic intelligence agency, Putin shouldered at least some of the blame, in Yeltsin's mind. Putin's political fate now seemed tied to Yeltsin's unpredictable whim. Yeltsin summoned him again on December 15th, this time to the Kremlin during one of his rare days at the presidential office. He wanted to discuss the Starovoitova case, the outbreak of racist statements in the parliament, the plot against Berezovsky, and Putin's progress in restructuring the FSB. Putin emerged from the meeting emphasizing that he had not lost the president's faith, while sounding like someone who worried he had. He accused those spreading the rumors, apparently from inside Yeltsin's warring camps, of wanting to sow seeds of uncertainty among the administrative and executive staff of the service or weaken its control. At the base of the rumors lies fear, he said, fear of the security service. Putin seemed to be barely clinging to his position. He announced that when Yeltsin ended his term, then barely a year and a half away, he would resign to make way for a new intelligence chief under a new president. It's clear that I'll have to go.